This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Security, surveillance, and the Bill of Rights, are they still compatible? That's the question being asked at a continuing ed conference for attorneys with the Vermont Bar Association tomorrow in Montpelier that has been organized by my guests. David Kelly has been practicing law in Greensboro, Vermont for over three decades. David Kelly, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You have an article in the upcoming Journal of the Vermont Bar Association called Taking Terabytes Out of the Constitution, Can We Fight Terrorism Without Big Brother? And your article opens this way. Last year, my wife and I hosted an exchange student from Pakistan. We wanted to help improve relations with Pakistan. By communicating with this student and his family and friends, without ever knowing it, we gave the National Security Agency, the NSA, carte blanche to delve into every corner of our lives. David Kelly, how could this be, that this simple act of hospitality would have that result?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of a difficult question to answer, because I can't imagine that the laws of the United States could be interpreted that way, but the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act have been interpreted such that when you communicate with a foreign person, the usual strictures of the Bill of Rights of the Fourth Amendment no longer apply. You have opened yourself up to the same kind of surveillance as a foreign person without the rights of an American citizen. So that means your emails, your address book. We Skype with our former exchange student and his family. We exchange emails all the time. We're pretty actively involved in his life, even though he's gone back to Pakistan. And we've become friends with friends of his through the internet. So I've never done a Freedom of Information Act request, and I have no idea what actually has been the consequences of that. But I do know that the laws of the United States have been interpreted such that our internet communications are now an open book.
And we know a lot more about what's in that book, thanks to Edward Snowden. So you have been looking at the specifics of the Snowden revelations, as has been reported by Glenn Greenwald and others in the media. Which I might note, won a Pulitzer Prize for Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Barton Gellman at the Washington Post last week. So it's an interesting aside that the highest journalistic award now acknowledges that the Snowden revelations, were really essential to the both functioning of a free press and a free government. What have we learned from those Snowden exposés, and what have you learned as you've looked into this?
I think the most important lesson I've learned is that there are huge shortcomings in our current federal statutes right now, and I would say that the biggest shortcoming is the fact that there is no workable, legitimate path for whistleblowers to bring forward concerns about civil rights violations on the part of the intelligence community. If you look at the past history of whistleblowers who sought to follow the rules, you see names like William Binney, Thomas Drake, Thomas Tamm. Each of those people tried to go up the chain of command and met dead ends repeatedly, and eventually wound up talking to newspaper reporters who likewise won Pulitzer Prizes. And as a result of talking to those newspaper reporters, they were prosecuted. Thomas Tamm's case, he was prosecuted not only by the Bush administration, but by the Obama administration, despite the fact that when he made his disclosures to the New York Times in 2005, President Obama was outraged. He, as a constitutional professor at the University of Chicago, immediately recognized that the warrantless eavesdropping that was being conducted to circumvent the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court by the Bush administration was illegal, nevertheless continued to prosecute Mr. Tamm right up until the last minute.
And remind us who Thomas Tamm is.
Thomas Tamm was an attorney, a man I went to law school with at Georgetown University Law School, and he became an attorney with the Justice Department, the Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, and in that office learned about the warrant, the efforts of the Bush administration to do surveillance, circumventing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court process. He became concerned that it was illegal, went to his superiors. They told him to sort of look the other way. He went to a staffer on the Senate Intelligence Committee who likewise told him to look the other way. Eventually, he contacted a reporter at the New York Times. It took a year for the New York Times to decide to disclose the stories because the Bush administration lobbied so aggressively to keep those stories out of the paper.
And this wasn't just any year that the Times took. It was the election year of George Bush.
That's right. It was 2004. That's right.
So the Times
waited till after the election.
Exactly.
That's true. And then as a result of those disclosures, we got the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments of 2008. Those disclosures led directly to changes in the law. And I think Mr. Snowden's revelations likewise are going to lead to substantial changes in the law, which is a good thing. And this has almost become a repeated sort of habit with the intelligence community. Back in the 1970s, one of the reasons we got the Church Committee was because anti-war activists burglarized the Media Pennsylvania FBI offices and disclosed efforts of the FBI to disrupt the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And that led to the Church Committee, which led to the creation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in the first place.
So, and here you're alluding to the fact that domestic surveillance and freedom have the tension between these has a lot of history here. Remind us of what the Church Committee, what it was, when it met, and why it was convened, and what kind of reforms came out of it.
Well, and what you say about the history, I think, is important because the Church Committee was not the first instance of these types of problems. We had the Palmer Raids. Interestingly, the Palmer Raids in 1920, where we rounded up 10,000 people, and an interesting footnote was that those raids were organized by a 24-year-old employee at the Justice Department whose name was J. Edgar Hoover. Which set him on his career path. We had the Japanese internment camps during World War II, which were sort of an outgrowth of a similar type of crisis atmosphere. But during the 1960s, the Federal Bureau of Investigation became active in disrupting parts of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, engaged in efforts that went beyond simply investigating and observing, where they would actually take a role in disrupting nonviolent protests, spreading some false rumors about people like Gene Seberg, Martin Luther King, and the burglary at the media office of the FBI began to open that up. And then we had the Watergate issues, which compounded the problem. And then I think there were some disclosures on the part of a reporter, Seymour Hersh, at the New York Times, about some of the domestic surveillance that was being done by the Central Intelligence Agency. And so the U.S. Senate decided to create a select committee on intelligence activities, and they named the senator from Idaho, Frank Church, as the chairman of that committee. Howard Baker was on the committee. I think Gary Hart was on the committee. And during those hearings, we learned that the FBI had collected something in the neighborhood of a half million dossiers on American citizens. And the Central Intelligence Agency had also been involved in surveillance of so-called anti-war activities. And to somehow rein in the intelligence community, the Church Committee recommended that we create the permanent Senate Committee on Intelligence Oversight, and that we create the permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Oversight in the House of Representatives. That came to pass. They also recommended that we create a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to issue warrants and oversee some kind of a legal process for this kind of surveillance. I would say today, looking back, that that court has some shortcomings. And
That's an understatement. The FISA court is known for having said no to almost nothing that has come its way in the way of permissions to do surveillance.
Well, in the last 10 years, there have been 35,000 applications for surveillance, and they've rejected 11 of those applications.
Okay, I stand corrected. That's not nothing.
Well,
11 out of 35,000.
11 out of 35,000. That qualifies as a rubber stamp.
Yes, yes. We are talking to David Kelly, an attorney from Greensboro, Vermont, who is organizing a conference in the Vermont Bar Association on domestic surveillance and the Bill of Rights. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So the Church Committee, which was not a religious body, was named for Senator Frank Church, investigating COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI that also had the CIA spying on American citizens, resulted in a number of reforms and a lot of pulling back. But now we find ourselves in the 2000s, really back to where we started, where the NSA, this body that's so secretive that we don't even know its budget, it turns out, is spying and tapping the phone calls and emails of American citizens. So is this a case of one step forward, one step back? We're right back where we were in the 70s?
No, I don't think so. I think that that the Church Committee's recommendations that were adopted, limiting the tenure of the FBI director to 10 years instead of lifetime, which is what it was with Mr. Hoover, creating the FISA court, I think that creating the intelligence committees in the Senate and the House, those were all good reforms. And I think what we've learned now is that with the advances in communications technologies, it's time for new reforms. I think the most meaningful effort in that direction has been the Leahy-Sensenbrenner bill. I think that bill it's a bipartisan bill. Jim Sensenbrenner is a Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Senator Leahy's a Democrat chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The fact that those two people who are leaders in the issue of constitutional law in the House and the Senate can put their minds together and agree on a way forward, I think their proposals are probably the most meaningful reform proposals.
Tell us what those proposals
would do. Number one would create a public advocate who would be a participant, an active participant in the FISA proceedings. It would make the FISA proceedings much more transparent and open to the public. The decisions, especially decisions involving unique questions of law, would be available to the public. It would significantly limit the use of national security letters by the FBI, which can be used as a fishing expedition type of subpoena without warrants. The The creation of a public advocate, I think, is perhaps one of the most important reforms. President Obama said he would support that. He says he supports it only in significant cases. I don't know exactly what he means by significant cases, but
what's a public advocate do, and who do they answer to?
FBI would go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or the NSA would go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and ask for warrants. That court traditionally has been an ex parte court. The only participant has been the government agency seeking to do surveillance. The public advocate would be a voice for privacy, for the First Amendment, for freedom of association, for free speech, an advocate in other situations. For example, in the prosecutions that were engaged in with respect to Mr. Binney or Mr. Drake or Mr. Tam, one of the issues was this so-called secret witness doctrine, where if the federal government wanted to prosecute somebody, they could use witnesses that were secret, that the court could listen and nobody else. And those kinds of doctrines are antithetical to our notions of a free and independent judiciary and an open judiciary and the right to confront your accusers. The public advocate would be an avenue to put those issues zealously before the court, whereas today, at the FISA court today, you don't have any adversarial process. The records and decisions of that court are secret. The proceedings are secret. There's nothing like the traditional chain of review. In fact, the judges on that court are appointed by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's no confirmation by the U.S. Senate. So the court has functioned in a really unusual way relative to the rest of the judiciary in the United States.
That's putting it mildly. This sounds like something out of the Dark Ages.
Well, it's Kafkaesque.
With hooded, judges and the like. You write in the article you have that's coming out shortly in the Vermont Bar Association Journal, you write, "I worked in the former Soviet Union for 2 years. I saw what happens to free speech when people think their communications may be monitored by the government. People develop a filter between their minds and their mouths. They dare to criticize soccer players but hesitate to criticize public policy. Likewise, when government monitors people's associations with other people, especially would-be activists, their freedom of association wilts." What were you doing in the Soviet Union, and how much do the revelations we've learned about with Snowden remind you of that world that reigned during Soviet times?
Well, back in the early 80s, friends of mine and I were concerned about the Cold War and the arms race, and it at that time looked like things could end badly. We thought, even as citizens in small-town Vermont, that we could perhaps do something to make things better, and that our notion was by creating normalized high school exchange programs, we could create a healthier atmosphere between our countries. And as it turned out, in 1985, and Presidents Gorbachev and Reagan had the exact same idea. And so the program we started, Project Harmony, took off. And with the support of the Freedom Support Act, Bill Bradley's bill in the Senate, we wound up exchanging literally thousands of students across the countries, both countries. And I wound up working there, first organizing student exchange programs. But then, since I was a lawyer, and I'd spent a year at the Russian Research Center at Harvard preparing materials for other American lawyers on Soviet law, a number of American companies started to call me up and ask me to help with their contracts, which I happily did because I still needed to make a living. While I was there, what I discovered was even during the Gorbachev era, Soviets were scared. They knew that there was widespread surveillance. They knew if they, when we first went over there, Americans were not allowed to visit the homes of Soviet citizens. It was illegal for us to be in their homes. We went anyway, and eventually the laws loosened up, and our students were able to stay in Soviet homes, which was one of the exciting changes that we got to witness. And we also witnessed the opening up of the Soviet economy, and I was able to see how that worked. Let me tell you an interesting story. I'll try to make it quick, but most of my work was done at what was called the Mezhdonarodnaya Hotel. I came into that hotel once with a taxi driver, and the taxi driver was not one of the drivers who was bribing the police at the hotel, and so they told him he had to get out, and I got in a bit of a scuffle with the police because I thought that was more corruption than I could handle at the moment. They took us both down into the cellar of the hotel. And in the cellar of the hotel, there were banks of video screens all around the security offices. Every single room in the Mezhdonarodnaya, the international hotel where international businessmen like Armand Hammer did business, every single room was videotaped and watched. And I'm not even sure how many American businessmen ever even understood that. But that is a pretty scary atmosphere, and a lot of Soviet citizens understood it, and it created a good deal of fear and a good deal of reluctance to talk about controversial political issues.
And does the situation we find ourselves in now, where in a sense every single room in America has some sort of surveillance device, if it is in any way connected via telecommunications?
Well, you know, I think our challenge, there's a great difference between us and the Soviet Union today. And there's our traditions, our values, our cultures are radically different. I think the fact that we have people like Congressman Sensenbrenner and Senator Leahy making very thoughtful efforts to reform this problem speak to that difference. What our challenge is to somehow adopt our legal system and our Bill of Rights to the new communications technologies, to this world of cyber intelligence that we live in. And the difficulty is that we lawyers do not move as fast as the minds in Silicon Valley. The electronics communication systems are evolving so rapidly, and our legal system is struggling to keep up. But there is nothing that I find comparable. I don't think the Soviet, well, it's not the Soviet Union anymore, but I don't think that the Russians values towards free speech or freedom of association or privacy are anything like our own today.
So what motivates your passion to pursue these issues 30 years after you were in the Soviet Union? And you continue to work with high school students. You're the debate coach at Hazen Union High School, I know. Why are you still working on issues of privacy and national security?
Well, you know, most of us go through chapters in our lives which are, I think, crucibles. They sort of shape our values. And the time I spent in the 80s and in the early 90s working in the Soviet Union and working in Latvia, I worked in Latvia for a while, I think I developed a much deeper appreciation of our Bill of Rights. You know, when I was in law school, Georgetown had a really strong constitutional law program, and that constitutional law program produced people like Frank Mahady. It produced Tom Hayes, one of my heroes. Frank Mahady was one of my heroes. Senator Leahy. It produced an awful lot of people whose commitment to the Bill of Rights, I think, is very deep. But that education, compounded with 2 years of watching people afraid to talk about political issues, was a pretty formative chapter in my life.
Okay, well, David Kelly, attorney from Greensboro, Vermont, I want to thank you for joining us on this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back after the news.
inventory isn't about products, kid. It's about money. Product sitting on shelves is money sitting on shelves. I hate overstock. I hate understock. I hate wasting time. I hate wasting money. That's why I love Grainger. Grainger KeepStock solutions help us manage our facility's inventory so we have exactly what we need when we need it. No more, no less. It's inventory management my way. Get it? Got it? Good. Visit Grainger.com/KeepStock for more information. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
Walgreens has a question. Where do you go when you need a few groceries, but the grocery store is a hassle? Like an I must have walked a mile already. Why is the milk always at the back of the store hassle? Walgreens also has an answer. It's us. We're just around the corner with the essentials, like milk, snacks, and paper towels, so you can get in and out fast. Walgreens, at the corner of happy and healthy.
Now with card and in-store coupon, Nice Brand facial tissue is just 99 cents, plus earn 1,000 balance rewards points on 4-pack Kraft Easy Mat cups for $2.99 with card.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. 156 people are known dead, some 150 others still missing since that South Korean ferry sank last week. AP Radio's Rita Foley reports that the families of those still thought to be on the sunken ship want the teams to find everyone on board.
Relatives of the missing are pressing the government to quickly finish what has now become a recovery effort. But the work is even more complicated now, as divers have to rip through cabin walls in order to find and bring to shore the remaining victims. And a sensitive issue is looming in the background, the question of when to bring in the cranes and begin the salvage effort by cutting up and raising the ferry. The government is warning that the work might eliminate air pockets that could be sustaining survivors. I'm Rita Foley.
11 crew members, including the captain, have been arrested or detained in connection with the investigation into the sinking. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Vermont Community Loan Fund borrower and Vermont business owner Bob Light talks about the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
When my wife Lee and I wanted to expand our Hollister Hill Farm bed and breakfast and to expand our farm store, we looked around for a loan. Traditional lenders weren't interested in our business plan. Then we heard about the Vermont Community Loan Fund. The loan fund looks at lending differently. It isn't just about the bottom line. It's about building Vermont's future, Vermont's businesses, and jobs.
The Vermont Community Loan Fund is a mission-driven lender. We focus on people, not profits. We're lending money to Vermont's small businesses to help them succeed.
The loan fund really looked at the whole picture with us. They saw how we were an asset to Vermont. Now, we're growing and proud to contribute to what makes Vermont work.
If you're looking for a business loan, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, where we look at lending differently. Visit investinvermont.org.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. In our second half hour, we'll be talking about the right to know and genetically modified foods. The issue of labeling foods that contain genetically modified ingredients has taken hold in states around the country, with more than 20 states having seen ballot measures or legislative initiatives in the past 2 years. Around the world, 64 nations, including China and South Africa and all countries in the European Union, currently require that genetically engineered foods be labeled. In the U.S. Congress, there is a bill currently pending that has 65 co-sponsors that would require nationwide labeling of genetically engineered products. On April 16th, the Vermont Senate voted 28-2 to approve legislation that would require foods produced using genetically engineered food to be labeled in Vermont. The minor changes made by the Senate must still be approved by this in the House, which previously approved the measure 99-42. Pending the governor's signature, the law would take effect July 1st, 2016. Unlike other state labeling laws, the Vermont labeling bill is the first bill which will go into effect regardless of actions by other states. Previous GMO labeling bills have required that a certain number of states enact similar legislation before they would take effect. To talk about this, my guest is Vermont Senator David Zuckerman. He's chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee and has been involved in this issue for many years. Senator David Zuckerman, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate having the opportunity.
Well, bring us up to date. I know that this is very fast moving and things are happening as we speak on it. So what is the latest on the GMO labeling law?
Well, frankly, as we speak, the House chamber is currently debating the bill. They are debating whether or not to concur with the adjustments that we made in the Senate or not to. I believe that will ultimately prevail. I think the committee vote on agriculture was 9-2 to concur, and the committee vote on judiciary was 7-4 to concur. The Appropriations Committee also signed off on it. So with three committees with fairly strong votes supporting agreement with the Senate version, I believe they'll pass it within an hour or two.
What is the significance of Vermont passing this law?
I don't know how to indicate truly how significant it is. Nowhere in the United States, and really in North America, are these products required to be labeled at this point, even though as you opened the show, you discussed how all around the world, millions, in fact, billions of people have their food appropriately labeled so that consumers can make a decision. Of course, consumers will make whatever decision they want. Sometimes it's based on price. Sometimes it's based on flavors. But now it's one more piece of information that will be on the package. And Vermont doing this is really setting a line in the sand and saying we want it labeled here, too. We believe that there's a legitimate interest for Vermonters to be able to know whether they're concerned about the environmental consequences or health consequences, and that we've our citizens have that right to know.
I ran into one of your colleagues, a state senator, on the morning of the Senate vote, and he told me that of all the bills that were being considered in the Senate this year, this one seemed to have gained the most traction and generated the most heat. And he was a little mystified as to how GMO labeling came to be kind of the hot issue of the current legislative session. How do you explain it?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of Vermonters as a whole being aware of their surroundings, their food. You know, we've had a tremendous growth in farm-to-school programs, in buy-local programs. People as a whole are really focusing on what they're eating. And I think, frankly, some of this comes out of even 9/11 when people started wondering, where am I living? What is my surroundings? What am I doing? And folks have started to remember, oh, yeah, we are what you eat. And so I think it's a culmination of many different factors. We've also talked about GMOs in Vermont as a policy issue for well over a decade. So I think Vermonters are much better versed on average than a lot of folks in other states in the country. And, you know, there's been a few years' worth of effort really building this momentum to this point. And one thing that I found particularly impressive with the constituent activity is that while there are groups helping organize that, The effort, really, many of the calls and many of the emails have been individualized. There are form emails that have come, but people really do have a passion about their food.
New Hampshire has also been considering a GMO labeling bill, and I believe that bill went down there. One of the state reps there, Bob Hafner, told the press that he was concerned that the label, the GMO label, could serve as, quote, a skull and crossbones, suggesting to the consumer that there's something dangerous in the product when, in fact, science has shown there is not. How do you respond to that?
Well, I guess there's a couple factors there. One is there is no indication in the wording whether GMO is good or bad. That's entirely up to the consumer. And actually, when I've spoken to some Monsanto representatives at some national legislative forums, they've actually conceded that their side has done a very bad job of articulating why they think it is safe and good for the planet and good for whatever they think it's good for. But, you know, there are questionable scientific scenarios, and there is very questionable, particularly environmental scenarios, to the use of GMOs. There's an article in a very prominent farming magazine called Successful Farming, a conventional farming magazine, and its front cover was 120 million reasons to be concerned about herbicide-resistant weeds. And the reality is that in Tennessee alone, and then you multiply this across the country, it turns out to be billions, but in Tennessee alone, they're expecting to spend $120 million more on more potent herbicides because the weeds are becoming glyphosate resistant or Roundup Ready resistant. And so the issue is really growing in terms of what chemicals we're going to have to start using in growing our food because of the overuse of this technology. So I think, you know, there's a lot of counterarguments to that person's argument.
Farmers, some farmers, especially dairy farmers, have been divided on this issue. Can you explain their concerns and your response to them?
Well, you know, a lot of dairy farmers have embraced this technology, a lot of the conventional dairy farmers, and in part it's because it does, in the short term, I think it does make some aspects of farming a bit easier and a bit more reliable in some instances in terms of the crop yield. You know, if you can spray a more benign herbicide like glyphosate, which is not a good herbicide, but it's a lot less bad than some others. And you can spray that after the crop has come out of the ground and kill those weeds off when your crop is a little bit bigger. You actually can do less, it's less management in terms of timing on when you spray, and it's in some ways more cost effective for them. On the other hand, when you use that tool year after year after year on the same plot of land, then you end up with the situation where you end up with these tolerant weeds to glyphosate, and it's going to turn the tide. So some of them feel that it's been a reliable tool, but unfortunately it's become such a reliable tool that it's turned a little bit more into a crutch where whereby by overusing it, they're going to remove its capabilities.
Is there a particular issue with confronting dairy farmers in that they may have difficulty saying that the dairy products are GMO-free if they can't certify that the feed has been GMO-free?
Well, actually, that's a good question. There are a few exemptions in the bill with respect to what needs to be labeled that it's been produced with genetically modified organisms. And actually, meat and dairy are the two largest exemptions. And the reason for that has to do with federal preemption. So the federal government already very much regulates all the labeling on milk and meat, and therefore we don't really have authority to regulate the labeling in that way. So Vermont dairy producers, there's nothing in the bill about fluid milk needing to be labeled. Now, if you have a adjusted milk product, so say you've got ice cream, and then it's got a lot of sugar in it, which could be beet sugar, and then it's also got, you know, chunks of something in it, so it might have high fructose corn syrup or the sweetener. If that product has GMO in it to more than 0.9% of its total content, that would need to be labeled. But straight milk products that are not added to by other GMO crops would not need to be labeled. And there's been contention about that. I know there are some folks that say meat shouldn't be exempted, that's eaten GMOs, milk shouldn't be exempted, and in my heart of hearts, I would prefer all food that's derived from GMO anywhere through the pipeline should be labeled. But we had to craft this bill in a way that we could fit within the federal constraints that we have. The other reason we had to put some of those parameters on is that the scientific questions around consumption of GMOs and it having a human health impact really revolve around direct consumption. If I eat cornflakes made from GMO corn, or if I eat, you know, directly that GM product, then there's the potential risk for the digestive system ailments that seem to be on the rise. But there is less evidence, and there's partly because there's been, or primarily because there's been much less research on it, that consuming something from an animal that consumed GMO, there isn't that secondary scientific evidence yet to back up our argument to have a state interest in requiring the labeling.
We're talking with Senator David Zuckerman, chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee in the Vermont Senate. We're talking about GMO foods. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. As this bill has worked its way through the state legislature, and it's been going on now for a couple of years, what pressure have you seen, or how has big agriculture, Monsanto and some of the other big GMO food product companies, made their presence and concerns known about this in the State House?
Sure. I think in some respects that's been one of the biggest surprises for me, which is that in the past when we were working on GMO legislation around the requirement for the seed producer to be liable, for instance, for the consequences of seed, which was back in 2006 or 7, their presence was significant. They were all over the halls, lobbying us regularly, threatening not to sell seeds in the state, et cetera. This time around, their presence has been much more subdued. And I think in part that's because the writing was on the wall. The amount of, as you indicated at the opening, the amount of constituent support for this bill is very broad, and I would argue relatively deep compared to most issues when people give us a call as their representatives and senators. People are really passionate about this topic, and people do support it. And so I think some of those companies just realized, why are they going to spend a lot of money fighting it when they're going to potentially lose anyway? The second thing I would, and this is all guesswork, I haven't asked them specifically why they haven't been as involved, but, you know, Vermont also has a pretty strong reputation for not wanting a lot of out-of-state interest. And I think if people saw a lot of commercials on TV saying, you know, tell your senator to vote no on this bill so that we can do this or that, and it was from national companies and sponsored by outside state organizations, I think that would have backfired, and I think they're politically savvy enough to know that. So probably they've saved their resources for the legal battle, which we all suspect will come, and chose to use the public airwaves in places like Washington and California, where they were really trying to change the mindset of people who were much less aware and informed about some of these kinds of things. For instance, in some of those states, they said, you know, your price of food could go up by as much as 10%. Well, people in Vermont already know that that's just not true because of our past conversations. So they really weren't going to be able to mislead the public the way they did in California and Washington.
So you've mentioned the legal battle that you expect. What do you think, what form will that take?
Well, I suspect that it won't be an individual company. Most people say, well, Monsanto is probably going to sue Vermont, correct? And that's actually not who I think will be the lead plaintiff. The lead plaintiff is likely to be an association, something like the Grocery Manufacturers of America or some other food producers group. And the reason for that is no individual company wants to be called out nationally as being the company that doesn't want to be transparent about what's in its food. And so they hide behind an association, and that way no one company can really be attacked for being, you know, very secret about what's in their food. So I suspect it'll be the Grocery Manufacturers of America, and they will probably sue us on any of two or three grounds. We think that we've got legal arguments on our side, but some of them have to do with federal preemption. Like I said earlier, we exempted the milk and dairy because of that bit. They also might sue us on First Amendment arguments. One would be that we can't restrict them from free speech, and we have indicated in this bill, and this is an important piece of the bill, that food that has GMO ingredients cannot be labeled as natural or all natural or 100% natural, because that's a false claim in our mindset, because it's not natural for GMOs to ultimately exist. And so that's a, quote, restriction on free speech. The second, with respect to free speech, has to do with something called compelled speech, where as much as an individual has the right to speak, they also have the right to remain silent. People are familiar with that, with court, you know, cases with individuals who have committed a crime. Well, in the same respect, they have a right to remain silent, supposedly, which would mean we can't compel them to say this contains GMO ingredients or may contain GMO ingredients. So saying that they have to label is an argument they will make. Now, where the legal debate occurs, and there are lawyers on all sides of this issue, is that the states also have rights. And so in the U.S. Constitution, you have states' rights versus First Amendment rights and versus federal preemption law. And those are where the legal discussion is really going to play out.
Senator David Zuckerman, the GMO labeling issue is personal for you. You're a farmer yourself.
Yep.
How will this affect you? What does it mean for you in your life outside of the statehouse?
Actually, for me, it means very little. There's been a fairly common misnomer out there that this is somehow going to help organic farms, and my farm is an organic farm, both vegetables and organic pork and organic chicken. And the reality, actually, if anything, is that it will, I don't think it's going to hurt organic farms, but it's certainly not going to help. And the reason is, right now, many consumers gravitate to organic to avoid GMO. It's the only label they know, other than now the GMO-free verified, which has started showing up in the last year or two in a prominent way. But really, a lot of consumers are buying organic as the only way out. And this will open a whole new category of food where you've got conventionally raised product, but not with GMO seeds. That will probably be at a price point significantly lower than organic, very similar to conventional food that's with GMO. And so some of those consumers may migrate back to that. Now, my job as an organic producer is to market why I think organic is better than just non-GMO. But that's, other than that, I really don't think it's going to have a major impact on my farm one way or the other.
So all eyes nationally are on Vermont around this GMO issue. What do you think the rest of the country can learn from the action that Vermont seems poised to take now?
Well, that will be a really interesting thing to see. I know that a lot of other states are looking at this. I would think that if a small state like Vermont can do it and say, we're willing to support this and take on the risk of a lawsuit even with our limited budget, that hopefully it would give a little more sort of support or backbone to some other legislatures around the country that say, well, if Vermont can afford to take on this potential lawsuit risk, certainly we can too. And so hopefully it'll help spur some of that on. And, you know, there's a citizens referendum in Oregon this fall. I think our successful passage of this bill will help spur that on because it will, again, dispel some of the myths that I think will probably come across the airwaves by some of the opponents to such legislation. And in the end, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years we'll have fairly broad labeling across the country because just like marriage equality and just like some other bills that we've passed in Vermont and laws that we've put into place, we've shown that all the fear and all the sort of boogeyman features that the opposition claims will happen don't actually happen. And once that happens, you know, the cards will fall and other states will pass labeling as well, would be my suspicion.
Okay. Well, Senator David Zuckerman, I want to thank you for joining us on this week's Vermont Conversation.
I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, and thank you for the time.
Okay. In our final segment, we'll turn to Dan Barlow, the policy manager for Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Dan, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, David.
So VBSR has actually polled its members on the GMO issue. What has been the support for it among the 1,000-odd member organizations?
That's a great question. So we did late last year ask our members if they think that the legislature should make a priority this year out of passing GMO labeling legislation. And we heard that, you know, 80% of VBSR members thought this should be a priority for the legislature. I think, you know, overall support is probably even larger than that, but they really signified that this should be a top issue for our organization to focus on. And it's quite exciting to be here today. It's, you know, the culmination of 3 years of work for us.
So what remains now? The House votes on it, and then what?
Our expectations within the next hour or so, the House will vote to agree with the Senate version, and then the bill will be off to the governor for his signature. He indicated at a press conference the other day that, you know, he never quite says if he will or won't sign a bill, but if you read between the lines, it was clear that he probably would support this bill. And I think the process it went through in the Senate, where they really looked at the legal questions, especially Senator Sears' judiciary Judiciary Committee. I think that helped build support among all the Senate and also with the governor, because this is a bill that he thinks that the state can easily defend itself on.
So we're likely to see this signed this week or next?
You know, it's always an open question about when he signs the bill, and I expect maybe with something like this that there could be they could organize something that'd be a little more public, because I think this does have broad support in Vermont, and you know, I know I'm looking forward to popping that champagne bottle open.
How many years has this been on the agenda? Well,
for BBSR, you know, we've been working on this for 3 years in the building. Previously, we worked on legislation in the early 2000s around the labeling of genetically engineered seeds. But, you know, we jumped on support of this bill in the last biennium when it was in House Ag, and it seemed like a long shot at the time. And it's quite amazing the distance we've come in 3 years.
What other bills are you following as we're now into this final end game of the legislature?
Sure. There are a couple bills that are taking up a lot of my time now. One of them would be increasing the minimum wage. As you remember, the House passed a bill recently making the minimum wage $10.10 starting in January 2015. Senate Economic Development took the bill, and they passed a version that would be a $10.50 wage in 2018 with several steps up until that point. And now it's been sent to Senate Finance Committee. So it's looking like there'll be big differences between the House version and the Senate version, and it'll be interesting to see how those are resolved. Another bill taking up a lot of my time is is S-239. That's the bill allowing the state to regulate toxic chemicals and consumer products, and that bill was just sent to House Ways and Means, and it's already been approved by the Senate.
Now, the minimum wage bill, it's kind of a curious course that it's following. The governor supports it, but not quite as fast as the legislature. So how do you think that's going to get resolved?
You know, it was I got to think that the final result may look a lot like what the governor asked for. The House was much more aggressive in its timeline. It jumped to what he was asking for several years earlier. And the Senate's kind of taken a more interesting approach, where even in 2017, it wouldn't be at where the governor wanted it, but in 2018, it would be above where he was asking for it. So I have to think, however this shakes out, that the governor will probably get his way.
Okay. Any other bills that are we should be looking out for over this next week or so?
Yeah, another bill that we've been trying to get moving is the bill expanding pre-kindergarten services in Vermont that was passed by the House last year. It's been in the Senate Appropriations Committee all session long, and I know that the number of school budgets that went down during town meeting have some lawmakers kind of spooked about moving forward on this bill, but it clearly has broad support from business groups and, you know, the education community, and it's pretty clear that this minor investment now will save school districts money in the long term.
And what is the status or current fate of paid sick days?
Sure, that was, you know, one of the bills that just didn't make it very far this year. The House General Committee passed it out, and it hasn't gone anywhere since then. There was no clear path forward for this bill. I know House Speaker Shep Smith, you know, is a supporter. I think he does recognize that having tens of thousands of Vermonters without any safety net in case they get sick or a child gets sick or a family member gets sick is a big concern. So I expect that we'll see this pop up in the next biennium.
Okay. Dan Barlow, thanks for joining us again on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David.
And that'll do it for this week. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 for the Vermont Conversation.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners, make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Russia is again threatening to act firmly, it says, if there's violence in Ukraine against Russians or Russia's interests. Ukraine has been moving against pro-Russian gunmen who are occupying government buildings in eastern Ukraine.